Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. We're also at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about Samaritan's Purse Operation Christmas Child Project. I'm delighted now to welcome Luis Alberto Urrea. He is the author of the new book, Into the Beautiful North, which just came out in paperback, and he will be in Santa Fe as part of the Meet the Authors series 2010 for a reading, discussion, and book signing this coming Sunday, the 27th of June, from 5 to 6:30 at the Inn and Spa at Loretto, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a beautifully crafted novel, and it's a real page-turner, about some young people from a village in Mexico called Tres Camarones, and that village has pretty much lost all its men to northward migration. And the book's heroine, Nayeli, sees the movie The Magnificent Seven. She decides to go on a mission with her friends to repopulate the village with seven good men. I love it. Preferably warriors. Did you, like Nayeli, come up with that idea while actually watching The Magnificent Seven?
You know, honestly, the roots of that weird little plot twist come from my dad's hometown in Mexico, which is called Rosario in the state of Sinaloa. And it's really the basis for Tres Camarones. But my uncle had the movie theater, which was the scene at Pedro Infante. So I put the movie theater complete from real life in this novel. And you'd go to these crazy movies in this tropical, sweltering movie theater that had bats in it and stuff. And they were always these really messed up double features, right? You'd see, like, I don't know, they're like Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and Love Story. You know, these mismatched. And you'd see these westerns that were old and had already been around the world a million times, and they would be dubbed into inappropriate languages, and they would have Asian subtitles and all this stuff.
Exactly.
So, yeah, the genesis of that came from sitting there watching those in this little theater and how magical it seemed to me, you know, when I was a kid visiting down there and knowing that our kids have never seen The Magnificent Seven. And, you know, you just start, as a writer, you start extrapolating what might happen in this abandoned town. The women are trying to figure out for the first time ever how to take power and what to do with that power. And, you know, they come to the attention of some bandits and they don't know what to do about it.
Well, the women are very powerful. Tia Irma runs for mayor and wins, and Nayeli can hold her own and does so. I mean, she can fight off people who are up to no good. And it's wonderful to read them. But the group goes to Tijuana, and I was wondering, I mean, you were born in Mexico, and you know Mexico, but you grew up in the United States. And how do you, as a writer, make the United States foreign to yourself so that you can see it through the eyes of your characters?
You know, I think you'll understand this. I was born in Tijuana. I was raised back and forth. You know, I came to the United States almost about 5 years old, a little younger than five, but I, you know, wandered back and forth. It didn't occur to me that they were separate worlds at all. But I was also a child of poverty, you know, and I spent my first years sort of as a barrio/ghetto child, no money and no hope of ever having money and no chance to ever go anywhere to see the world. And, you know, we settled in a working class suburb a little later, and I got to go to high school and college and so forth, and I had all this hunger for the world, but no way to get there. And I didn't get out of San Diego until 1982. So in a real sense, when I left San Diego and saw the rest of the world, it was kind of a magic realist experience. You know, I was astonished by those things I found out there. And I have relatives who are still in Mexico, and so I've always had this immediate experience of people coming to the United States and being completely blown away by whatever the thing is that they encounter, which to us seems trivial, but to them is monumental. For example, my brother, I have a half-brother, also named Luis. I don't know, my dad must have liked that name a lot, but
right.
He's Luis Octavio. And I remember when I was a kid and Star Wars came out, he brought his wife, who didn't speak a word of English, and we sat in a far corner of the theater, and he asked me to whisper an ongoing translation of the movie into her ear while she watched it. And they were so completely flabbergasted that there was something like this movie. You know, they were in love with the theater itself, but they were totally blown away by this movie. And I've seen that my whole life, people coming here and sampling how magic it is, you know. Even my dad, you know, my dad wanted to speak English so badly that he would learn phrases because he thought they were so cool. Like, if you ordered a soda, you'd always say easy ice. He thought easy ice was something maybe James Bond would say, you know.
Right. Well, I was reading that you used that example in the book, and I was thinking that's one of those many examples of a word or a phrase that a foreigner learns and they think that they can speak English, but nobody else even understands it.
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a whole passage where the character Chava Chavarin, who now, you know, he's been in the United States a really long time, and he considers himself an expert, and he's trying to teach these young'uns how to say cool American stuff, but you realize that he's so far out of date. You know, he's using 60 hipsterisms to people and things.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk for a moment. You just mentioned the phrase magic realism, and I have at different times read novels that are supposed to be magic realism, and then traveled to Latin America, and then read the novel again, and you think, maybe this isn't magic realism. Maybe this is just realism.
I agree with you 100%. Even Garcia Marquez used to say that. You know, I think it was in his famous Playboy interview. In one of those interviews, he said, you know, when I was a little boy, there was a guy who could heal cattle. He could heal them of worms and parasites. And he said, and I went to watch him do it, and all he did was stand in front of the cow and raise his hand to the cow and do some sort of incantation, and the cow actually vomited up the worms. And he said, when you've seen that, what's so weird about what's in my book? And, you know, that whole sense of magic, it's really in the fabric. Even in my family, the family who actually lived in this town was a very intellectual, scientific kind of family. But the whole atmosphere is permeated with stuff that is just almost surrealistic. You know, even if it's just something like those crazy movies in the movie theater while you're bombarded by fruit bats and John Wayne is speaking German, you know. It's like this really weird scene.
I just have to tell you, as an aside, my father used to love spaghetti westerns, and he watched I don't know if it was a spaghetti western or a John Wayne movie, but it was one of those things translated into German, and the cowboy comes up to the bar. The English is, give me a whiskey, and the German translation was, ein Cognac, bitte.
That's awesome. That is so good. I have a similar one. I saw the War Wagon down there. It's John Wayne and Kirk Douglas, right? And they're plotting to steal the money from an ironclad stagecoach. And again, it was, you know, it was in German, and I couldn't stop laughing. And I think my relatives thought I was brain damaged. You know, they're like, would you be quiet? That's not funny. But every time John Wayne would yell, you know, Raus, mach schnell dumm Kopf, you know, I'd be like, oh my God, I'm going to lose it.
I know, it's German does not lend itself to Latin subjects. I used to collect salsa music in every foreign language I could find, and they have it in Japanese and Finnish and even Dutch, but there's no German salsa music for good reason.
Why.
Yeah. But anyway, back to your book. We're talking to Luis Alberto Urrea. His book is called Into the Beautiful North. One thing that made me happy was reading this book was that there are a lot of characters in it that you can love. And for me as a reader of fiction, that's very important. It sometimes amazes me how many novels have been written in which there's not a single character that you can love.
Yeah, and I know.
Is that true for you as a writer?
Yeah, because, well, you know, on a certain level, I guess you feel like you have intellectual cred if you've created a book with reprehensible characters in it. But, you know, I also thought, I mean, it's always been an interest of mine, or perhaps an obsession of mine, to write a literature of witness. I, you know, to try to present life ways and stories and so forth of people who don't get represented and don't get championed. It's so easy to attack people who have no one to protect them or to defend them. And I thought it would be kind of subversive to write a zippy book. In fact, it just got voted one of the top beach reads by Latina Magazine, which made me crazy happy because I've never been a beach read before, you know.
Right.
But to write something that might be a popular kind of novel that still maintains an attitude of witness and would also, through its plot, make American readers who wouldn't normally do this perhaps root for people that they would be tempted to possibly look down on.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't help but root for them. And you also, I mean, there are a lot of things in it that your typical American reader probably doesn't even realize. One of the examples is that Mexico has its own immigration issues with immigration coming from south of their border.
Oh, yeah. You know, I have to say, this tour has been kind of tumultuous. It's been amazing. A lot of people showing up. But the comments always sift out to things like, I didn't know that Mexico had immigration problems. And that gives me the chance to tell the audiences, you know, Mexicans do not have an illegal immigration gland in the body that,
right,
you know, kicks off at 13 and starts pumping illegal immigration hormone that tells you what to do. It's a question of desperation. And the problem is that there's desperation south of Mexico. And if you know, you go into Mexico and if you listen to talk radio, it's not that dissimilar from Glenn Beck or someone else ranting and raving. And I heard when I was in Guadalajara at one of the book fairs, you know, a guy on talk radio saying, we've got to stop these Guatemalans coming in our border. It's an unsecured border. We need a border fence. We need to militarize the border. And he said, you know, they're coming in here and taking Mexican jobs. They're getting health care. They're getting a free education. And I thought, wow, if you translated this, people in the United States would not believe it first. And if they have at all a twisted sense of humor or an ironic eye, they would laugh because they'd realize that it's not just people on our talk radio, it's people on their talk radio.
One of the things that's kind of odd about that is, I mean, here in the United States, we don't really have that many I suppose there are some, but, you know, going overseas to find better jobs than we have here.
Right.
But in Mexico, you do. So you've got people coming in from the south, but also people going north. Do the same talk show hosts decrying immigration from the south? I mean, what do they feel about their own immigrants who've gone to the U.S.?
Well, I think they're very defensive about it, you know, because America, the United States of America, is certainly getting more draconian, right, in our responses. And I think it makes Mexico a bit defensive. But they also have a very interesting view on this. And they're like, you know, like yesterday, for example, I got in Dallas, Texas, an angry woman started yelling at me with a voice quavering with rage about Mexicans and the Mexican government being responsible. It's not the United States' fault. It's the Mexicans' fault. And you want to say, well, I understand your frustration. However, you know, the fact is that there is employment. People don't come here for a vacation. There are jobs waiting for them. You know, the Mexican side of the coin says, well, look at the issue of drugs. You know, the narcos exist to service the hunger in the United States. Look at the issue of weapons dealing. Thousands of weapons a week flow south into Mexico from the United States. So their position is one of, you know, go ahead and be angry at us if you must, but take a look at your part in this. Still, and I think they want to, you know, completely paint themselves in a better light, so they blame us. We blame them, they blame us.
One of the examples that you give, and the first chapters of this are kind of a, they have little, they don't come off as didactic, but if you want to read them, they're a little bit of a didactic lesson in some of the roots of immigration, and one of them is NAFTA, and, you know, tell the story about the beans being grown in Mexico. And
yeah. Well, you know, I first started noticing this even in the 80s. I used to work with a missionary group, the Tijuana Garbage Dump, and, you know, with orphans and prisoners and so forth, and I've been involved with that community for a very long time now, so for example, when you get to the dump in the novel, that's all real stuff, lived
yeah.
stuff. But, you know, I started noticing that beans were getting more and more expensive. And, you know, you'd go to the Tijuana fruit market and you'd be buying Mexican beans and they were insanely expensive all of a sudden. And one of the fruit market guys pointed out to me, said, well, yeah, they're grown in Mexico, best beans in the world, and they're shipped to Los Angeles, where they're repackaged and then shipped back and resold to Mexico. And you realize that all these steps had taken place. So at that point, and the peso had just been devalued at that time, people could not afford to eat the food that they themselves were growing. They couldn't afford to buy tortillas. And, you know, there were times when it felt like the end of the world because you thought, how is anybody going to survive this? And the NAFTA thing was, you know, as some people predicted, NAFTA, for example, while I was working on Devil's Highway, in fact, the year I was working on Devil's Highway, which was 2004, I guess, 2003, 2004, over 400 maquiladoras closed down because NAFTA did what it was supposed to do, and people found cheaper factories in China instead of Mexico. And, you know, I still remember the headline in one of the Mexican newspapers, which was, and now they've taken our jobs, speaking about China. You know, China's gotten everything, and now the jobs are gone, too. And
right.
though maquiladoras aren't anybody's idea of a good time, really, they were the employment, and they were one of the stopgaps at the border, which then vanished. So, you know, next stop, Burger King, right? People need to work.
Yeah, I mean, it's another kind of short-sighted thing that we have as Americans, and we're not the only short-sighted people in the world, as you mentioned. But people go places because they're desperate and they need jobs, and you know that's what my ancestors did. That's what almost everybody's ancestors
oh,
did
yeah.
here. This lady in Dallas, her great-great-great grandparents probably came from the Irish potato famine.
Yeah, yeah, of course. You know, and the thing I get a lot from people is, well, you know, my family were immigrants, but they came here legally. And I think, okay, fair argument, but when I'm in a bad mood, I say they came here legally. So did Crazy Horse stamp the papers? You know, did Geronimo accept that visa? Because those guys, you know, go to the res someday, they don't feel all warm about it. And so it's, you know, it's a pattern. And it's not just in the United States, of course. It's a global thing. There's a huge, you know, I think, sense of migration and movement all over the planet. I don't know what it means, but certainly paradigms are shifting wherever you look. You know, and you look at places like Spain, which has tried all kinds of solutions with Morocco and Africa, you know, including fences and outright violence and shooting. And then all of a sudden they decided it would be more expeditious to pay people a fee to go home. We'll go ahead and send you home and give you a nest egg if you'll go home. And they've been buying people's repatriation, which I think is an interesting thing, too.
It is interesting, and it's, I mean, not to go on too much about immigration, but this thing about, oh, they came here legally, it's really neither here nor there. They would have come if they could because there was a labor market, not because they were legal, and it would be legal here now if we had politicians who were doing their job properly.
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, if you look at the history of it, I you know, one of the things I always say about this immigration issue, especially now with SB 1070 and everything's revving up all, you know, if you just look at the history of it, if you just calm down, stop listening to propaganda. For example, nobody really knows what the immigration law is because nobody looks it up. They think it's some heinous criminal law, and I think, well, why don't you look up immigration law? It's right. You can look it up on the internet. You know, it's a chapter, I think 1326 maybe, of Title 8 federal law, and you can see that it's a civil law. It's a law about contracts and torts, and you know, it's the law that oversees speeding tickets. So it's hardly, to begin with, some sort of felonious assault on the United States. Legally speaking, I think that's interesting. But, you know, you can see across the board that there's so much to the history that's fascinating, you know, that the original versions of what became the Border Patrol were an anti-Chinese expeditionary cavalry. Their first job was to chase down Chinese people.
Right.
That was in the 1800s. And, you know, a lot of the migratory pattern of the workers was kicked off into overdrive, at least, when we put Asian farm workers in camps in World War II. Mexicans were brought north. And when the war ended, they were thrown out. And if you look back in history, the actual government name for that was Operation Wetback, something that, of course, that nobody would get away with calling now. But it was pretty hardcore stuff. But you can really see some of the patterns of where the history of this stuff came from.
We're talking to Luis Alberto Urrea. His book is called Into the Beautiful North. Another character in the story is the city of Kankakee, Illinois. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, Kankakee.
And at first I thought you just chose the place for its name. This is the place where Nayeli's father years ago had gone to, and then after a while nobody ever heard from him, and part of her going to the north is not just to find these seven warriors, but to find her father. But Kankakee, Illinois is an interesting city, and there's some very interesting stuff going on there, both as a city that's trying to revive itself and as a city that's dealing with its immigrants.
Right, yeah. Well, of course, Kankakee is a great name, but, you know, you can't go wrong with a place called Kankakee. But, yeah, in the paperback, there's an essay I did for the New York Times sort of explaining a little bit about the town. But, you know, living in Illinois, the librarian in Kankakee invited my wife and me to come down and do a reading, and I was really charmed because she said, now mind you, when you drive down here, don't hit any turkeys on the highway. And I thought, wow, these guys have got turkeys walking around, you know? And I thought it was going to be some little old brick library with the requisite six retired ladies with a plate of cookies, and I thought, that'll be sweet, let's go. And it turned out to be absolutely the opposite of what I thought was going to happen. There was a corporate tower that had been turned into the city library, and there were these revelations upon revelations about this place. And it was interesting to me that Kankakee, you know, voted one of the worst cities in the country to live in, Rust Belt, everybody fleeing, the industry dead, run by a mayor who had been there for a very long time, a local boy, conservative Republican guy, no liberal progressive visionary or anything like that, just a good conservative Midwestern mayor with a dying city who suddenly sees 6% Mexican population in a place that has never seen Mexicans. And he thought, what is going on? And he went and he investigated the workers. And he asked them, basically, where did you come from? And they were, most of them, from the same region in Mexico, which was León, Guanajuato. And so he decided, in some sort of act of, I don't know what, it's just genius, in my opinion, took people from the city, politicians, library representatives, whatever, and flew to León, Guanajuato. And had a meeting with their mayor and essentially said, why are you invading Kankakee, Illinois? And the mayor said, we're one of the poorest cities right now in Mexico, and we've been voted a bad city to live in. In other words, they were the same city with the same kind of problems. And somebody had found work in Kankakee and sent word back, and everybody went to get work so they could send money home. So this mayor decides to start a sister city relationship with León, Guanajuato, forgetting all politics, forgetting all paranoia, forgetting all the agitation, all of that. He realizes on the spot, we can do something to help each other. They shake on it. They become sister cities. He comes back home. He immediately begins things like process toward citizenship, if that's what you want. Workshops to help those workers get low-interest mortgages so they can buy some of the abandoned real estate and have lives. He totally tricks out the library into a beautiful high-tech operation that's a safe zone where there's lighting late into the night. It's open, especially late on weekends. Kids always welcome. They have a truce, so there's no violence there. He gets Chicano, Spanish-speaking police officer to keep, you know, to help the Hispanics. So instead of having the panicked, oh, these illegals are ruining my town, he sees that as a way to repopulate the town and get it rolling again. And in a further, I think, amazing move, when they started tearing down some of our housing projects in Chicago, like Cabrini Green and so forth, you know, a lot of families were displaced and really weren't wanted. And they sent people to find these families and said, you're welcome to find homes in Kankakee. So they brought in Latinos and they brought in African-American people. And, you know, their neighbors don't like it. The neighbors call them the ghetto in the meadow.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Can you dig that? But, you know, it's working. It's working in its own quirky way. And I was so moved by that. And I was so moved by the librarian, who is the actual hero at the end of the book, Mary Jo Johnston. She was just a wonderful woman. And I just thought, this is unexpected. So it was really interesting to me to try to go to unexpected places in both countries, and also to show that, you know, we take for granted that we are magical too. We forget, you know, with all the malaise and all the recession and all the BP spill and all the awfulness going on, we forget that this place is magical, and someone who would come here would be completely stunned by what they'd find once they got here.
You know, it's another layer to that that's so fascinating, is that Kankakee made its library the center of its operations, and Guanajuato is famous for its big Cervantes festival every year. So they're both literary cities.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You know, the word is regenerative. And, you know, I was so fascinated by the power of story, because really the whole thing, my whole novel is generated by various stories and by what I consider sacred objects, which are written objects. You know, Nayeli's journey, although inspired by the Magnificent Seven, is really, the seed is laid by a postcard, right, that she receives, and she carries it with her everywhere she goes. It's all she has left of her father, one miserable postcard from Kankakee, Illinois. But that's from my own youth, being a poor boy in San Diego, and I would get these postcards from people or letters, and they became sacred objects. They were holy. These people I loved and missed wrote to me, and it was their handwriting. You know what I mean? They had touched it, and yeah. I had a picture of a place that I could dream about going to. And it's something we don't get anymore, I don't think. But it felt like, you know, kind of a ritual object. If I were going to kick off a myth or a fairy tale, then I think that was the ritual object that started it.
Interesting. We're talking to Luis Alberto Urrea about his novel, Into the Beautiful North. So you got out of basically, what would you call it, poor San Diego border town life, first as a missionary before you became a writer?
Oh, no. I was a writer from the get-go, I think. You know, I was the kid hiding under the blanket with a flashlight so right. I could read some more Ray Bradbury stories, you know, and listening to James Brown on my little AM radio. And you just always have the bug, I think. I loved stories. I loved them, and I loved reading. And I think I discovered writing probably in junior high. Certainly by the time I got to high school, I was the writer guy. You know, I was the guy writing the poems and who carried around notebooks all the time. And I guess as a kid, you're always looking for your identity, right? And I guess that was mine. And, you know, I went to college. I was the first one in my family to go to college. Met Ursula K. Le Guin. She was my discoverer. You know, she published
really?
A story of mine. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it was amazing.
Were you writing sci-fi?
No, not really, though. I was really interested in sci-fi and fantasy when I started, and then I was really fascinated by, you know, what at that time they were calling anti-story, you know, like Robert Coover, those crazy stories. And then I was discovering certainly Latin American lit. So, at that time I was just having a fever with the possibility. Richard Brautigan or Julio Cortázar, you know. I thought, wow, Gabriela Mistral, her poems, wow. Everything was possible. And she came and she ran this workshop, which had a couple of people. David Brin, the science fiction writer, he was in there. She just sort of took me under her wing. I think she had a certain amount of sympathy for me. And she used to call me, and since you've read the novel, you'll understand this. Her nickname was Dia Osa, the she-bear, my
right.
aunt the she-bear. So you can see where that name came from in my novel.
Right, right. Tell us more about the tour that you're going on for this book. It sounds like you're having quite a time with your audiences.
Wow, it's been some adventure so far. But I'm with my wife. We try to do book tour together. We like to call it the Amazing Race Urea Edition, you know, as we go from city to city.
That's
but,
nice.
We're doing a lot of it driving, which is really fascinating. So we spent last week all over New England. And this week, it's been a little brutal. You know, we did a couple of cities and several events and interviews in one day yesterday. So I was walking into walls, man. I didn't know what I was doing. But the audiences have been really cool. I mean, you're used to, you know, book tour is usually 1 to 11 people. And, you know, they don't know who you are, or a couple people do. And you know, you just go out there and do your thing. And it's been much nicer. I mean, it's been, you know, 50 people, 65 people, 100 people. I don't know where they're coming from. I'm very happy to see them.
But they've heard about it, and they want to talk about some of the issues.
Oh, yeah. They want to talk about the characters. You know, they just... I've been amazed at the big love. You know, when the hardcover came out, people were really nice. But there's a lot of just affection, and it makes me happy. And people are gravitating to different characters, which is really interesting. You know, a lot of people, of course, love Nayeli. A lot of people like Tacho, the young gay man in the novel. But a lot of people have really focused on Atomico, of all things.
I know. Tell us about him. That's an amazing character.
Atomico? Oh, God. Well, if you like The Magnificent Seven, you might have seen The Seven Samurai that inspired it. And in The Seven Samurai, there's an unacceptable, flea-bitten, irritating Ronin warrior played by Toshiro Mifune. And that's really the Atomico character. He's the... You know, he's this rogue, kind of wily coyote character, you know, who inadvertently is heroic, and he's on a quest, and he's looking to do something meaningful with his life. And I think people gravitate toward him because he scares them, but then you realize that it would be really cool to have a kind of scary guy protecting you who's really noble underneath all of his bluster, and that if he's around, bad things won't happen to you.
Well, and he's a blustery guy with a hut by the dump with very high self-esteem.
Yes, he is. He's proud of himself. You know, I think unless you get involved in garbage dump culture, and it's a culture worldwide, you know, but unless you really get involved with them profoundly, you don't necessarily understand that to us it may be really dirty and disease-ridden and horrifying and ugly. But to the people who live within that culture, it's a culture, and it's a skilled job, and you have to be an apprentice to learn how to do it, and there are levels of accomplishment within that world, and he's a guy who has fled to the garbage dump after getting in trouble in the Mexican army, so he has some fighting skills and some discipline, and he's a garbage picker, and he's made himself a little compound, and he's quite proud of himself for having engineered his hut out of all these things he's found in the trash. And he's got a specialty of finding abandoned puppies, and he raises them. So he has these loyal dogs, and he has a staff. The garbage pickers often have these long poles with a nail or two at the end, and they use those to dig through the mounds of garbage and to find stuff. But he's turned his into a fighting pole after having seen The Seven Samurai on PBS. From San Diego, because he has a TV set he found in the garbage that he's hooked up to car batteries like people do, and he's watching PBS of all things, and he decides, wait, I'm a samurai, I'm one of those guys.
Exactly.
And that is actually inspired by my cousin Hugo, who was sort of the family pistolero, the crazy, you know, gun-toting cousin, who did in fact see, I think it was Yojimbo on PBS, and decided he was Toshiro Mifune and began this one-man campaign to become Tijuana's samurai. So, you know, there are always roots to your stories, but that's where Atomico came from.
Has your work been translated into Spanish, and do you have a Mexican audience, a Latin audience?
Yeah, it's Hummingbird's Daughter, particularly, is going around the world, and I get these editions, you know, I get Chinese editions and Hebrew editions. It's just amazing. But both Hummingbird and Beautiful North are in Spanish. Hummingbird's in Mexican Spanish, and then Spanish from Spain.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. And the Spanish, apparently being the Hummingbird's daughter, wasn't acceptable. So in Spain, she's the daughter of hope, which doesn't mean anything. But, you know, and it's told in better, more elegant Spanish. So it loses the whole vibe because it's supposed to be country talk. Beautiful North is also in Spanish. And I was so thrilled. I didn't even know this, but about maybe a month ago, Tijuana had a literary festival, and an actress from Tijuana did the presentation of my work, presenting me back to the hometown. I had no idea about it, but she wrote to me to tell me. And I thought, that is so cool. You know, that made me feel so good. Because they're suddenly thinking, wow, there's a guy from one of our colonias who's writing books in the United States that people are buying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It made me feel happy.
So, is there any possibility that this book could be made into a film?
Well, you're just a prophet. You have the gift of prophecy.
I hope so, because it would make such a great movie.
Well, check it out. It's being developed by Nikki Caro, who's the woman who directed Whale Rider. She made Whale Rider and North Country, and she's working on it.
Well, can you insist that there is a heavy Mexican production influence in it? Because it would be a shame if they did what they did with the House of the Spirits and things like that and had...
I know. William Hurt and Meryl Streep, right?
Yeah, it was so wrong.
Yeah, it was really odd. She's wonderful. I mean, I'm really thrilled to have a woman director who adapts her own screen place, because it's such a women's story. But also something that's kind of magical is that she's from New Zealand. And so she sees both of these towns as wildly exotic.
Right.
You know, and it's hard for us to have many phone conversations, but when we do, she's got this, she really wants to go to Tijuana. She wants to start in the Tijuana dump and then take the entire road trip. Which excites me, because that's a road trip I take a lot. So I told her, all right, I'm taking you to Vegas, and then we're going to Rocky Mountain National Park, and then we're going to go to Kansas and see the 6,000-pound prairie dog, you know, and we're going to drink Slurpees.
Right.
You know, so I'm really excited, because I think it will be a revelation, because she sees the United States as having as much magic as the Mexican village.
Well, just make sure I'm telling you what to do, but just make sure she casts Mexican actors who look like the characters that you are writing.
I know, right? Where are you going to find an Atomico? I don't know. But Nayeli especially, you know, I want to be very careful, because a very specific person, and I don't want a little, you know, dewy-eyed ingenue, because this is a warrior. This is a warrior woman who doesn't even know, I don't think, that she's a warrior. You know, she's a soccer star. She's taken great pains to be in good condition, because, you know, she has some sense that maybe that's the only way out. But then she realizes, I think, to her heartbreak, that there's no place for a young woman like her. And, you know, Aunt Irma has made her study martial arts, because she has a sense Nayeli's going to have to beat a few evildoers down in her life. So she's a very physically strong, charming, no question. But what I don't want is, you know, some sort of sex bomb in the role of Nayeli, if that makes any sense.
Right, of course. Or somebody with, you know, pure white skin and blue eyes.
Yeah, blue-eyed Nayeli. Wouldn't do. In fact, I try to make it a point several times in the book to point out that other people tell her how dark she is, and she's totally shocked.
Right.
In fact, she thinks at one point, well, I always thought of myself as kind of white. And she realizes I don't want to give too much away. Let's just say she meets an African-American Border Patrol agent at one point and suddenly thinks, wow, my skin's not that different from his skin. Mm-hmm. It's a shock to her because she's never even thought about it. She's never thought about skin color. But here she is, and she tells the agent, your skin is so beautiful. And he starts laughing. He's like, what? Thanks. My skin's beautiful, really?
Well, much more to talk about, but I'm afraid if we go too much further, we're going to give away the whole book. So
yeah,
people should just read it. It's called Into the Beautiful North. We've been talking to Luis Alberto Urrea, and he will be in Santa Fe this coming Sunday, the 27th of June at 5 o'clock at the Inn and Spa of Loretto. It's part of the Meet the Author Series 2010, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great. Love Santa Fe. Can't wait to get there.
Good. We welcome you when you get here.
All right.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm happy now to welcome Philip and Rose Struck. They're with Samaritan's Purse, which we're going to talk about. And if I may also say, they're the wonderful parents of the folks who run this restaurant.
Yay.
Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And you've created three wonderful kids who probably everybody who's come into the Santa Fe Baking Company has seen and met. But let's talk about Samaritan's Purse, which is this organization that you are part of. And it is, how would you describe what it does? You're in a specific part of it called Operation Christmas Child.
Samaritan's Purse is a natural relief and disaster organization. When you have a natural disaster like a volcano eruption or earthquake, they're on site immediately to provide disaster relief. But the Operation Christmas Child is a shoebox ministry, and Franklin Graham is the CEO, and the objective of the program is to put shoeboxes together with basic necessities for hurting kids around the world. And the shoeboxes have things like basic necessities, toothbrush, toothpaste, soap, school supplies, toys. Most of these children around the world have never received a gift.
And so these are things that actually come to them on Christmas Day?
Actually, most of the delivery does take place during the Christmas season. However, the distribution of these gifts goes on year-round because some areas are not reached until the summertime. And so most of them are delivered at Christmas, but right now there's some in, for instance, in Myanmar, trying to be delivered. There's some in Madagascar that have just cleared customs, and the gifts will be delivered. So it goes on throughout the whole year, but the emphasis is around Christmas time for these gifts.
I was looking at the website, and it's full of very happy, delighted children opening these gifts. Have you been part of that?
Actually, Mary Charlotte, we have been privileged to be on a distribution. The distribution is just amazing. The children receiving these gifts, as Rose stated, probably have never received a gift before. They're in very dire or needy circumstances, poverty circumstances, and we just have seen the joy and the hope and the love that they share with us, because they just kind of wonder, well, who's doing that and why are you doing this? But, yes, we have been a part of that.
We've also met some kids. They're called Full Circle Stories, and these are kids that received a shoebox when they were in an orphanage in Russia or Bosnia, and since have been adopted by a family from the U.S. But these kids talk about having no hope at all and then getting a shoebox and knowing that somebody out there cares enough about them to prepare this shoebox. One particular boy talked about getting his own washcloth. He said he had never, in all his years, he was about 10 or 11 at the time, had never had his own washcloth. And it's just amazing, because the U.S., we have an overabundance.
How does the stuff that goes in these boxes get collected together?
It's generated all through individuals. It's a program we consider children meeting the needs of children, and teenagers are involved in this with adults. So children, organizations, social clubs, churches, individuals all come together to prepare these shoeboxes. So they go out and buy necessities or things they want to pack in their particular shoebox. And this is just for children. So they're for children ages 2 to 14. So if they go on the Samaritan's Purse website, they can see what age group they might want to purchase for. Say it's a five to nine age group, and they want to do a girl. So they would go, and they'd give them suggestions on the website as to what they could purchase. And so they buy these things, stuff them in a shoebox. It can be a plastic box. It can be an actual shoebox that they've covered. Or sometimes we get these special decorated boxes around Christmas time that Samaritan's Purse provides. We also encourage, along with the gift, a note or a personal a picture, something personal that will be sent in the box, because oftentimes these children will write back and they want to know and thank you and communicate and have a relationship at least through the mail.
Do they ever end up being pen pals?
Yes, yes. We've heard of many that have been pen pals and have carried that on for quite some time.
We've had a story where a little boy in an orphanage had lost his parents, and they brought him a shoebox, and he just had no desire to even open that shoebox. And in the shoebox, he found a letter and a picture of the couple that had sent him the shoebox. And in the end, this couple ended up adopting this little boy.
Oh, my goodness.
It was just an amazing story. In the U.S. last year, we put together, with volunteers and other organizations, 5.2 million shoeboxes.
Good heavens.
And worldwide, 8 million shoeboxes. And here in New Mexico alone, we did 22,000 shoeboxes. So it's just an amazing ministry. There's over 100,000 volunteers in the U.S. and 500,000 worldwide. Phil and I do, we're year-round volunteers, and a lot of people will just come together maybe during collection week, which is November 15th through the 22nd. And that's when all the organizations and churches and individuals bring their shoeboxes to a collection site. But there's year-round opportunities for people that might have more interest.
Is this related to a specific church, or are there all kinds of churches that are participating in it?
It's interdenominational. No particular church is necessarily represented by Samaritan's Purse. Just Christian organizations, Christian churches, individuals. And like I said, even in some places, there's civic organizations, scout troops, MOPS groups. It just depends on the particular city. And our hope for this area, for Santa Fe and Northern New Mexico, which we are area coordinators for, is to generate more interest and more knowledge about this program and the wonderful opportunity for people to be able to seed into a life of a child and give them some hope for the future.
Now, when these boxes are given to the children, I mean, are there any strings attached? Do they then have to join a religious organization or anything like that? No.
There is a ministry part of it, and it is a Christian program. So in each booklet, I mean, in each shoebox is a booklet that tells you about the greatest gift of all. And that just to provide hope to these kids.
The greatest gift of all
is the birth of Jesus Christ.
If the children want, through the local churches where these gifts are distributed through in the various countries, they can sign up for a discipleship program where they teach them things from the Bible. They teach them things that they would want to know about the greatest gift of all. And if they complete the course, after I think it's a 12-week course, they can get a New Testament Bible in their language and a certificate of completion. But it's basically a children's ministry. But you got to remember that with the children, you know, adults are also influenced, each family that is represented by these children. So,
if people who are listening would like to get involved here in Santa Fe or in New Mexico, what should they do?
They could go on the website, SamaritansPurse.org/OCC, or they could call Phil or Rose Struck at 505-930-1710. Or 505-930-0146. And the team in northeastern New Mexico is a brand new team, and Phil and I came on board. We've been with Samaritan's Purse now for a few years, but as our own team, we started now in 2009, 2010. And we have five different teams that we're building now. We have community relations, media relations, church relations, and then collection week. And so we need members for each one of those teams.
Right. Well, Philip and Rose Struck with Samaritan's Purse, Operation Christmas Child. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you,
Thank you
Mary
very
Charlotte.
Much for your time.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.